I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you so much for listening, as I often say. Thank you to Mo for coming up with this idea. And here we are. This is going to be our last podcast for a little while. We're going to take a break over Christmas and the New Year. So I hope that's all right. I know that many of you really look forward to them every Monday morning. And so I'm always a little bit sad not to, so to speak, fulfil your desires. It's very important to me that that we keep loyal to you. So we are as loyal as we can manage.
You are loyal.
But we do need occasional little breaks. We have done approaching 200 podcasts. Believe it or not.
Have we?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yikes, as they say in old comics. Yes. So do you have wonderful plans for Christmas, Mo?
No, I will talk to you about that later, but yeah, fine.
But you've got the office Christmas party.
Oh, right, yes, office Christmas party. Yeah, I'm busy. I've got birthday party this evening, then I've got Bifford tomorrow, then I've got a screening on Monday. Dinner Tuesday, dinner Wednesday, Thursday or Friday. I'm supposed to be going to this, like, rave thing.
To where?
To a sort of rave. I don't know if I'm going to go. Saturday, I've got another birthday party. Sunday, I'm hosting you all for Christmas.
Yeah, that's
Monday,
right.
Monday, nothing. Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday, theatre. Thursday, office Christmas party.
Yes.
Friday, something that I haven't put in my diary, but in my head is telling me I didn't put in my diary. Saturday, Tom Mothersdale's Christmas party. Sunday, Megan's birthday party.
Oh, cracks. Well, I'm relatively quiet. I mean, we don't have the Christmas parties. We don't have the ones we used to have. The males party has been cancelled again. It's really the sort of, I turn down, as you know, I don't go to author lunches, author parties, book launch parties.
Well, you've got my Christmas party and the Garrick Christmas lunch, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that's plenty. I'm performing again the Garrick
Christmas. What are you doing this year?
I'm doing the Kingsley Amis again, which I've learnt specially so that I can do it without a prompt, which is good.
How long is it?
Oh, it's short. It's
how short?
It takes about 2 minutes. 2.5.
That's quite long.
You don't want any more. Besides, people want to get on with their lunch.
How many people do you have performing, though?
10.
Do they go in between the meal?
Yeah, in between the courses. Yeah. And we've got Russ Abbott top of the bill this year. Simon Buttress. Jeremy Nicholas.
And the Bishop.
And the Bishop. Richard Charters, former Bishop of London. Anando Mukherjee singing some Rodgers and Hammerstein. William Godfrey doing Noel Coward. There you go.
I don't think that many people probably even know what the Garrick is, let alone what the Garrick Christmas party means.
No, it probably doesn't. Probably better off. If you Google it, you'll find it.
Google.
So, well, this week, Mo, as I explained in last week's podcast, a nice lady called Susan Hill wrote to us and suggesting I did a case about a man called Peter Falconio, whom I don't think you'll remember, but it's actually quite famous.
We haven't done this one already, have we?
Not that I know of.
I know that name, though.
I'm sure you do. Everybody does.
Why?
Well, because it's a very well-known name.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure we haven't done it, Mo.
Okay. Doesn't matter if we have. If I can't remember it, then I'm about and everyone else no, will I'm, be ready
I,
to listen
I do,
to it
I do look through the list as well. I check against the list.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was actually rather good because it's a high name recognition but a low recognition of what the story's about.
Clearly, as I just illustrated.
Yeah. So, if it's all right, this week we're going to do...
Can I just quickly ask how this relates to last week's one? Because you kept saying how it was going to relate.
This is the disappearance of someone backpacking in Australia.
Okay.
That's how it relates.
So what are we calling this one? Just Peter Falconio?
I think we're calling this the disappearance of Peter Falconio.
He's a chap that disappeared.
He's the chap that disappeared.
Okay. This is the disappearance of Peter Falconio.
That's it. Peter Falconio was a British backpacker who disappeared off the remote Stuart Highway near Barrow Creek in the Northern Territories of Australia. That's the bit at the top, nearest okay. India or Asia. It was the 14th of July, 2001, and he was travelling with his girlfriend, Joanne Lees, in a very distinctive VW camper van. You know, the flat front and...
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you know what they look like. Yeah. Everybody, I think, knows what a VW camper van looks like. Falconio was 28 and so was Joanne. He was the third of four sons to a family from Hepworth in North Yorkshire. And he met Lees at a nightclub in the town. They lived together while Falconio was studying at the University of Brighton, not the University of Sussex, and then decided in November 2000 that they would take a trip, a proper trip, and they would do it, a kind of gap year of those days, okay? And they decided to go to Nepal, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, and end up in Australia. You know, a real proper trip. I can't imagine anything what I'd like to do less, but never mind, they liked to do it. But their parents, both Lee's and Falconio's parents, were, because of the backpacker murders, literally only a matter of years before, were rather anxious. And indeed warned them. They bought the camper van, didn't travel in the camper van all the way, they bought the camper van when they got to Australia, so I understand it. But on the 16th of January 2001, they arrived in Sydney, thinking, well, we're going to do the proper road trip in Australia. And they would go to Canberra, which of course is a bit south, and then back to Melbourne, then up to Adelaide, then up to Darwin. They were going to call in at Brisbane. It was a real, you know, proper trip. And they could live in the camper van. They didn't have to get a campsite. And they were 28-year-olds. They're very intelligent people. But around 7:30 in the evening of the 14th of July, 2001, they were driving from Barrow Creek to a place called the Devil's Marbles. They stopped off at a Red Rooster chicken restaurant to have something to eat.
Oh, Dad, I'm so hungry.
Oh, gosh. I'm sorry. Anyway, they were pulled over, a man driving, it's a desert, I mean, completely deserted, huge road in the middle of nowhere. They're pulled over by a man in a white four-wheel drive Toyota. He seems to suggest, at least Falconio's driving, and he pulls up alongside him and says, I've seen something at the back of the camper van. So Falconio, being a perfectly upright and ordinary, doesn't expect anything or see any danger in this. So he stops the camper van and together the man, he walked round behind the camper van. And then Lees, who's transferred from the passenger seat to the driver's seat so she can rev the engine, so in case there's a problem with the engine, hears a shot out of the blue. And then the man who'd stopped alongside them appears at the window brandishing a revolver. Well, it's clearly something's happened here. He drags her out of the camper van, ties her hands and tries to tie her feet, but she refuses. And he pushes her, drags her into the Toyota. She is not prepared to accept this. Though her hands are still bound behind her back with cable ties, she gets out of the Toyota while he's, I presume, attending to Falconio's body, and runs into the bush. It's dark, remember. It's completely dark, and it's absolutely deserted. Mm. I mean, there's not a street light. There's not a... The only thing you've got are the moon and the stars.
Literally my worst nightmare.
Yeah, you know. She runs off into the bush and hides. He comes after her with a torch, but doesn't find her. So she stays there for 5 hours, obviously terrified, still her hands still bound behind her back. And eventually, just after midnight, about 12:30, she emerges from the bush and flags down a passing road train driver. You know, those amazing Australian road trains, made up trucks, made up of two trucks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Great, great, huge things. And tells him what's happened. The Alice Springs police arrive at about 1:30, in other words, about an hour later, and begin a search for Falconio. They eventually find blood and the VW camper van hidden about 80 metres into the bush. But no sign of Falconio. But there is some DNA on the gear lever. Now, we should also say there was another case that has an impact on Peter Falconio. Do you remember the dingo baby?
Yes.
Yes? It was actually called Azaria Chamberlain. And in 1980, you may recall, she disappeared not that far away from this incident. And it was always suspected that the mother did it, yeah, and invented the crime. And so that's part of the background. So there's a backpacker murders, there's a dingo baby. Nevertheless, the police do find DNA on her T-shirt, which is not Peter Falconio's as far as they know, on the cable ties and on the VW gear stick. A long period passes with no real sign of finding who might have killed or kidnapped or whatever Peter Falconio. But eventually the police begin to look for the owners. They trace the owners of every four-wheel drive Toyota white between 1991 and 1990. One man they identify as having owned a VW, white VW Toyota, four-wheel drive, is a man called Bradley Murdoch. He's interviewed, but no DNA is taken. He's not interviewed until the 1st of November 2001. It's quite a long time has elapsed. But on the 17th of May the following year, May 20, 2002, Murdoch's drug-running accomplice, so Murdoch is no... saintly figure. He's a drug runner, basically. And his accomplice is caught, and a DNA examination of Murdoch's brother, not Murdoch himself, Murdoch's brother, leads to a DNA match to the T-shirt Joanne was wearing, to the gear shift of the VW, and to the cable ties. But indeed, Murdoch is not even arrested for the abduction and supposed murder of Peter Falconio until he's actually arrested on a completely unrelated kidnap and assault charge in South Australia, not Northern Territories where the crime was committed, but in South Australia. He's a peripatetic, as we've said to each other many times. The most difficult people to trace are peripatetic killers, because they're always moving. They use alias after alias. It's very hard to track them, pin them down. I can think of a British killer, for example, Peter Tobin. I think he had 40 aliases.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's typical. It's just another way of concealing yourself. Mm. Eventually, because of what they feel is conclusive DNA evidence, Falcone is extradited from South Australia to the Northern Territories to stand trial. And he stands trial in Darwin in April 2005. By this time, Lees has identified him from two photos in November 2002. She tells the court that she'd been forced into the back of the four-wheel drive, but had escaped into the dark. There was a great deal of argument about how there wasn't a back to the four-wheel drive, and she was forced between the seats, and an attempt to muddy the water, essentially. But the DNA matches were very important. Nevertheless, Murdoch's defence counsel suggests that this transference of the DNA could have happened in the Red Rooster restaurant that they'd stopped off to have chicken.
Hmm.
Yes? Actually, it's wonderful, this. It's one of those real coups de théâtre in the trial, when it emerges that Falcone was allergic to chicken and would never have ordered chicken, either for him or his dog.
I've got a dog.
Yes. Not surprisingly, I say that with the benefit of hindsight, but it really wasn't all that much of a stretch. He's a very dodgy character, to put it politely, and he had no alibi, and he was in the Northern Territories.
Wait, hold on a second. Who was ordering the chicken? Who's allergic to the chicken?
Falcone. It's not Falcone. Bradley Murdoch.
Okay, right. I was going to say.
Bradley Murdoch.
Okay, he has a dog. Okay,
he was allergic to chicken.
Okay, so the bad guy is the bad guy.
It's unlikely to have ordered chicken.
Okay, I got it.
So the DNA and this odd argument about the chicken saw Bradley Murdoch given life with a minimum sentence of 28 years. What they call in America a non-parole. In other words, you can't apply for parole until you've served 28 years. It was later revealed, only of course after the trial had been completed and the conviction found, that Murdoch had been acquitted of aggravated sexual assault on a mother and daughter in South Australia some many years earlier. He'd been acquitted. In 2017, the Northern Territories newspaper received an anonymous letter saying that Murdoch had cut up Peter Falconia's body and put them in two large bags and given these to an associate to be buried in another remote part of Western Australia. Well, we've already said Australia is enormous.
A good place to hide a body.
And it's you take forever. I mean, you couldn't do it.
If ever.
You mean, it's
probably never.
It also emerged that he was a gun fanatic, that Bradley Murdoch was a gun fanatic, and he drank amphetamine-laced tea while he was driving his truck. Capable of doing very remarkable mood swings. He had, if you look at a picture of him, he had very long, lank hair. His front teeth were missing as a result of being in a fight.
I just looked up Peter Falconio.
Yeah, but if you look up Bradley Murdoch, he had
I hate to say this, as I appreciate that it's not an appropriate comment, but he looks very Australian.
Now I'm not allowed to say anything's inappropriate, so... He was a drug-smuggling trucker. He was 45 years old. He had what somebody once described in court as wild eyes and a very dodgy record. But he often got away with the sexual escapades because, of course, he was travelling all the time. He was going from place to place relentlessly. No one has ever found Peter Falconio. It's been the subject of a series of television dramas. Joanne Lees, the girlfriend, has told her story. She's written a book about it. There's a lot of books about the Falconio case. It's very famous, probably more famous for the name than anything else, because actually the crime itself is, I suppose, it's a crime of opportunity. He saw a young man and a young woman, or And he thought he was going to have an opportunity to clearly to rape the young woman at the very least, and dispenses with the only danger to him, which is her boyfriend, without any delay. It is the classic eliminate the man to attack the woman arguments.
Yeah.
And that is the case of Peter Falconio. But I want to ask a question. I was asked this week, or last week, could I define the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath? Okay, well, I'll try, but actually they are really quite similar. In other words, a psychopath is normally, and there's no such thing as a perfect example. Nothing in criminology works by being it's exactly this or it's exactly that or it's exactly... A psychopath is usually defined as someone who has quite often considerable intelligence, the ability to present as an ordinary person, could be charming, can be very chatty, can be very ordinary, and classically targets victims. A sociopath, according to one definition, not the only one, a sociopath, by contrast, is a spree, impulse killer, rage-driven or lust-driven. Now, the two seem to me to be very, very close together. I was asked, I'm always asked the same question, is there such a thing as the killer gene, and is it nature or nurture? And we've talked about it so often, but I thought this was quite interesting in relation to Bradley Murdoch, because is he a psychopath or is he a sociopath or is he both? Or is his distinction nonsensical? Molly's wriggling her nose. He's in a sense, he's a spree killer.
Psychopath, sociopath.
Hmm.
So I guess you would use this, as is just off the top of my head.
Yeah, sure.
And on the understanding, I don't know the correct definition for either of these
absolutely.
Terms. But I'm just thinking about how I would, if I was using those terms, who I would use them in reference to, for
yes.
example.
Okay.
So I feel like the term psychopath, I would, and perhaps other people like me potentially, would only use in relation to someone who was committing crime that was like horrendously deranged, or like was very was really extreme.
Peter
like
Sutcliffe,
very premeditated.
The Yorkshire Ripper.
Yeah, exactly. Or okay. someone who like tortured Fred West, like
yeah.
tortures their victims,
yes.
and like that person is a psychopath. A sociopath, I feel like people would more likely use in relation to people existing among us.
Okay.
In which I mean, like, I know people who might be like, oh, that person's a sociopath.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean? So it feels like perhaps it's sort of one level down, and that you could be a sociopath without being a murderer. Maybe
okay.
I mean that. I don't know.
It's a very interesting thought. I mean, is it someone like... a supermarket killer.
But it also gives to me the sense of someone who's just like out to cause destruction everywhere.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
I do.
They're just really like maniacally disruptive in
so
society.
You've got an assault rifle and you march into a
exactly
in
yeah.
a Walmart and you shoot six people.
Yeah, but you also might just stir up and initiate bad feeling and violence and stuff amongst people without it necessarily
killing.
Being something so extreme as that.
Yeah.
It feels like there's more, maybe so, there's a bit more range on sociopath than
yes,
psychopath.
Yes. It's very...
But I don't know every time we do a case, I don't immediately think psychopath, sociopath.
No.
I think that those terms are reserved for people who clearly illustrate that mentally they operate in a slightly different place.
Yes, but you're not saying they're mad.
I'm not saying they're not mad.
Okay.
But I'm not saying that they are either, but I think trying to think of the cases that we've done.
Well, do you think, for example, Bradley Murdoch or Ivan Milat, the last two cases we've done in Australia...
Or you think they're psychopaths or sociopaths?
Or do you think that it's...
Can't you just be a bad person?
Possibly.
Or do you think as soon as you've got to the point where you've committed crime... So, for example... Okay, here's an example. So, if I'm a drug runner...
Yep.
And somebody gets in my way and I have to kill them...
Yeah.
I would not define that person as a psychopath or a sociopath.
Okay.
Like, so the murder that they've committed is sort of... They felt was a necessity in the process of what they were doing.
I think that's interesting. And I would be very interested to hear from our listeners what they thought.
Yeah.
Because I think it is an interesting question. I'm very uncertain about that kind of labelling everybody. Because so often you wouldn't dream of labelling anyone anything. If you met... West in the street, you would certainly think he was just no more than a rather dirty little man.
Yeah, that's different because you always say that. Because you always say, oh, you wouldn't be, they were this, that, and the other, you wouldn't be able to tell that they were a murderer. But that's the whole point. It's
okay.
Not like anybody walks around being like, but even someone who's got borderline personality disorder or someone who's a schizophrenic, or you don't look at them and think, oh, that person's a schizophrenic. Do you know what I mean?
No, I do.
I think it's a bit dangerous to be like,
I agree,
that person looks like they could kill. I think the whole point of what we do is we're talking about the fact that that's the whole point.
Yes.
That it doesn't, there is no, there's no definition.
There's
like
no
you
definition.
Always say.
No.
You don't wear horns and have a tail.
No. But again, I think it's a fascinating question. Because we are constantly being asked, aren't we, you know, where does it all come from? Why did Ivan Milat suddenly decide to kill...
Yeah, but maybe we should look at it in the other way of, like, where does the nature of a person who is a philanthropist or gives for charity or decides to do good works, or, you know, where does that come from?
I'm not sure.
Like, that's the thing. Like, where does any of it... You know, when you've got a... You know, you got a child who, like, has a real bent towards looking after bugs or... Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like we're always asking the question in relation to the negative, but we never ask it in relation
to the positive. No, that's a very good point. Very good point. Well, one more. I think that's an interesting question. The other question, we've talked about this many times before, that there's a thing called the McKenzie Triangle or the Homicide Triad, which suggests that if a child is programmed to become a killer, that they will have probably wet the bed after the age of five, that they will probably have hurt the family pets or animals, and they will probably have set fires. Well, that's nothing. None of that's particularly new to us. We've talked about it many times. I don't think that's the key. I think that the Homicide Triad, which originally came up in America in 63, and then the FBI had kind of mutated it a bit and became known as the Homicide Triad. I think the more significant issue is the possibility of abuse, whether it's mental, physical, or sexual, in childhood.
Yeah, I agree with you, but we've also had this conversation many times too, which is like... There isn't a thing. There is not a defining thing. Of course, if you have a difficult
childhood
upbringing, it can turn to that. But in the same breath, people can undergo terrible trauma and not have that.
Absolutely.
So I think it's sort of similar.
I think it's very much what I feel is that we've got to be careful with labelling. I think that it's because every single case we do. It's different.
Yeah.
There's no... I don't think Ivan Milat was the same as Bradley Murdoch, for example, in the last two cases.
But surely that's the whole point of, like, other podcasts full stop, is that there are so many cases, there's so many people, there's so many...
Yeah.
And we don't... There isn't... There's no formula, otherwise it wouldn't keep happening.
It wouldn't keep happening.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that is the end of Peter Falconio.
Disappearance of Peter Falconio.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to all the people who help us.
Yes, and thank you to all the people who help us.
Our producer Sam Brain, my brother Dan, who did the music, my friend George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, and to Jeffrey for all the hard work, when he's fallen downstairs.
And to Molly for all her enthusiasm, for which I'm very grateful. And perhaps we should
That wasn't ironic.
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
It's entirely well meant, I promise you. And perhaps we should take this opportunity to wish everybody a happy Christmas and a very nice new year.
Merry Christmas. Thank you to all of the listeners, because you're the only reason we're here.
Absolutely. And so we hope you have a wonderful Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year.
Happy New Year.